طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Welcome to the August 31st edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by Sharif Fahm and continued in his memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Each week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. On today's show, we feature a speech by George Galloway speaking in Leeds about the current situation in Gaza. This was recorded on August 2nd of this year. Stay tuned for another thought-provoking edition of This Week in Palestine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much indeed for turning out in these extraordinary numbers. Something that was called and organized at very short notice. First, let me say this is a respect party meeting, and I'm going to be criticizing other political parties in this country over this subject. But that in no sense means that we want in any way to disincentivize or disrespect the contribution that individual members and supporters of other political parties are making in this great uprising that's taking place in this country over the issue of Gaza. Nonetheless, it would be dishonest of me to refrain from criticizing the performance of the leaderships of the three main British political parties, the three cheeks of the same backside that I talk about, and that's been nowhere more vividly evident than over this subject. So welcome everyone, whether you're a respect supporter or not. I think that we have the answer on Palestine. We have the policy on the Middle East and the wider Muslim world, and we have the policy that's needed here in Britain for our own people. And all of that I'll cover in the course of my address. This catastrophe, which is still, even as we speak, enveloping the Gaza Strip, did not begin 4 weeks ago. And as I said famously on another occasion during the 2006 war in Lebanon on Sky News with Anna Botting, you may recall the moment, you have to have a memory longer than 3 weeks. You have to know the background to what's happening now in order to understand what's happening now and in order to have any chance of advancing the kind of proposals that are required to resolve the matter. But if we just take the events of the last few weeks first and put them in seriatim, the events in which they occurred. First of all, three settler teenagers from an illegal settlement in the West Bank, which is entirely separate from Gaza. There is no border between the West Bank and Gaza. In fact, there's a very great deal of Israel between the West Bank and Gaza. Three settler teenagers were kidnapped and cruelly murdered in cold blood by somebody. No one has yet not established a case, no one has even yet produced a scintilla of evidence that any particular political organization was involved in this crime. We have no idea as yet who killed these three youngsters and why. But one thing you can say with absolute certainty is that nobody in Gaza was involved in the killing of these youths in the West Bank. If you simply look at the map, and you know, as you're about to know, if you don't know already, that Gaza is absolutely sealed off from the world. It is fenced It is watchtowered. It is surrounded on all sides, sea and land, and also, of course, entirely controlled from the skies. No one, but no one, can get out of Gaza to the West Bank. Simply impossible. So what was Israel's response to the killing of these three teenagers in the West Bank? It was to ruthlessly bombard and slaughter more than 1,400 people, most of them women and children, most of them younger, even than the three teenagers that had been murdered in the first place in the West Bank. Now, that's such an extraordinary thing, and yet the British media and political class continues to repeat the mantra that Israel has the right to defend itself, and that no country could tolerate the murder of these three teenagers in the West Bank. But ponder for a minute, during the Irish Troubles, for example, ponder for a moment that the IRA fired the rocket through the office window of the British cabinet and forced the cabinet members to crawl under the cabinet table. Imagine for a minute that the IRA blew up the Grand Hotel in Brighton and came within an inch of murdering the Prime Minister of Britain in her bed, and killed in any case several of her members of Parliament and other senior officials of the Communist Party. The Conservative Party, that's a Freudian slip. Imagine that such a thing happened. And imagine that the British response was to send our Air Force, our Navy, and our Army to ruthlessly bombard Dundalk in the Irish Republic. Not even Londonderry or Belfast, from which the IRA men came, but an entirely separate area, and to bombard it for 4 weeks and kill 1,400 Irish people. First of all, I hope, no British government would have ever contemplated doing any such thing. Secondly, I hope that if they did, the British media and public would never for a second tolerate the idea of collectively punishing entirely separate and innocent people for a crime committed by someone else. Imagine for a minute that the United States of America would have allowed Britain to do such a thing, given the support for Irish republicanism in the United States of America. Just make that comparison in your mind, just to see how grotesque what Israel is doing to Gaza is. My second point is this. It is frequently said, although it's a complete lie, that the resistance in Gaza is causing these huge numbers of civilian deaths, 1,400 dead, 7,000 maimed, most of them forever. There are no facilities, no rehabilitation, no wheelchairs. In fact, most of the wounded will either die or have their lives unalterably ruined in the course of this conflict. It says that the resistance is using these people as human shields. Again, I want to invite you to examine that statement. If it was true, what kind of people would murder the human shield? If, God forbid, I took two of you hostage here now and went outside with you in front of me as my human shield, imagine if the British police opened fire anyway and killed the human shield in order to get to me. Again, even the British police wouldn't consider doing that. And if they did, the public reaction would be completely, overwhelmingly against them if they did. But if Israel is telling the truth, that's exactly what they're doing. They want to kill you, but because you're hiding behind him and him and him, they're killing all of you. What kind of country is allowed to get away with that?
But making it worse, it's a lie, in any case. As Jeremy Bowen, the last respected commentator on the BBC, said very clearly, and he's there in Gaza, and I quote, "I have seen no evidence of Hamas using the people of Gaza as human shields." What they mean is that the fighters, the resistance, are living amongst the people. But everybody in Gaza is living amongst each other. There is no jungle in Gaza in which the fighters can hide. There is no mountains in which they can hide. Gaza is only 25 miles long and 4 miles wide. And almost 2 million people live in it. Do the maths. It is one of the most densely populated areas on the earth. There is nowhere for the resistance to be except amongst the people. And in any case, the resistance are the people, and the people are the resistance. Palestine doesn't have an army, goes without saying. It doesn't have an air force, doesn't have a navy. All it has are fighters with small arms, overwhelmingly with small arms. And they fight from their own street, because their own street is being invaded. Otherwise, there would be no one to fight against. And when I heard Ed Miliband on the radio yesterday begin at his number one point by expressing his sympathy for the British man who had been taken prisoner by the Palestinian resistance, and describing it as a kidnap situation, he said, "I want to say how sorry I am for the British family of the Israeli soldier who's been kidnapped in Gaza. If a foreign soldier invades your country and you capture him, how does that become a kidnap? He's been captured. He's a prisoner of war. He's in a foreign army invading somebody else's territory." But that was the most important point that Ed Miliband wanted to make. That's Ed Miliband, who announced, very bad timing I must say, a few months ago, that he was a Zionist. The very first British political leader ever to so describe himself. And people say to me, "Well, he's Jewish, so what? There's hundreds of thousands of Jewish people in our movement against Zionism. Religious Jews, leftist, secular, progressive Jews. You don't have to say you're a Zionist because you're a Jew." And Ed Miliband's mother and father would describe themselves as anti-Zionists. But Ed Miliband took very inopportunely the chance to declare that he was a Zionist. But that leads me to a point, because I think this soldier came from around here. Am I right? This so-called kidnapped Israeli soldier is from Leeds. There are many Muslims here from Leeds. If any one of them had gone to Gaza to help the Palestinian people defend themselves and then flew back into England, he'd be arrested as a terrorist and be banged up in a prison. How come British citizens can go to Israel and fight in the Israeli army invading Gaza and come back here without any threat of punishment? Is that not a double standard? What kind of double standard is that? It's the kind of double standard that infuses this entire issue. The third point that needs to be made is that the people who live in Gaza are not from Gaza. 80% of the people in Gaza are refugees in what was once their own country. Secondly, on that point, they are completely locked up with nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. All the gates are locked against them. Not just all the Israeli gates, but the one gate that leads to an Arab and Muslim country, Egypt. And now we know why Morsi was overthrown, so they could put this stooge military junta in power in Cairo, which would openly collaborate with the massacre of 1,400 Palestinians just across the border in Gaza. All these gates are locked. This is, as David Cameron once, but only once, described it, as the largest open-air prison in the world. Now again, can you imagine any guards on watchtowers, never mind bringing in airplanes and naval support, being permitted to bombard and kill large numbers of prisoners in a prison yard just because they were in a riot or because they were rising up against their conditions? It's inconceivable that that would be done. But that's exactly what's happening in Gaza. So there are 80% of them refugees, and worse than that, through the wire, they can see the land that was and is theirs, but which is being lived on and enjoyed by foreigners who came from England, from Leeds, from Paris, from Brooklyn, from New York, mainly from the United States, who are living on their land, while they for 67 years have been living in this cage as refugees, with no ability to move anywhere, no passport, no papers, no visas, no permission to travel, just trapped in this open-air prison and able to see, if they can get on a rooftop high enough, the very lands which they were driven from when Israel was created on their land. And this adds considerable insult to injury, you know. I mean, God forbid that any of you will ever suffer a superiorly armed force, more powerful than you, coming into your house, taking it from you, killing your old mother, killing your sister, driving you out, forcing you to live behind wire in a camp. God forbid that that should ever happen. But imagine that if you could actually see from the camp the house that was yours and where your parents were killed, and the whole of the course of your life and the life of your family was altered forever. That's the lot of the Palestinian people. So that leads me to my fourth point. They say that Hamas, which is shorthand, of course, for the resistance, there are many parts of the resistance, some of them are Islamists, some of them are leftists, they're all the Palestinian resistance. They say they're firing rockets. The question is not that they're firing rockets, but why are they firing rockets? They're firing rockets because their country has been wiped off the map. Their people scattered to the four corners of the earth. They're firing rockets because they're besieged, where actually every calorie that they consume is controlled by Israel. I'm not making that up. There's a whole battery of scientists in Israel that have calculated the exact minimum number of calories of food that should be allowed into the Gaza Strip. They're not very good at maths, because according to the United Nations, 80% of the children in Gaza are suffering from malnourishment. There's a lot of 80% in this story, by the way. 80% of the people are refugees. 80% of the children are suffering from malnutrition. 80% of the people are unemployed. And 80% of the people are living on less than a dollar and a half a day, when just a few miles away, Israel is one of the most prosperous, most developed countries on the earth. They're locked up like animals in a zoo that can be allowed a specific number of buns through the bars, but no more, who can have their medical services rationed so drastically that right now, under this bombardment, the hospitals in Gaza are in a state of total collapse. In fact, for the first time, Israel is openly admitting that it's bombing hospitals. And of course, just this week, we saw the sixth United Nations
hospital bombarded and more than 20 children killed, sleeping on the floor of a United Nations school in the Jabalia camp, which I know very well, and which is, you call it a camp, but it's actually a city. 120,000 refugees live in Jabalia camp, and the children were sleeping on the floor of the United Nations school. The United Nations told Israel 17 times their exact coordinates and informed them 17 times that the school was packed with women and children taking shelter from the bombardment. And last week, Israel rained down shells and missiles on top of that school and killed 20 children and wounded 65 more children and women. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, said that there is nothing, I'm quoting him, nothing more shameful than attacking sleeping children, which is quite a strong condemnation, except he hasn't actually done anything about it. Israel remains a member of the United Nations. It hasn't been suspended, hasn't been carpeted, no resolution condemning them has been brought forward. And this is the sixth United Nations school to be attacked in a period of less than 4 weeks. President Obama also made a strong statement for an American president. He said, this attack on this school is completely unacceptable. Now, in my dictionary, unacceptable is something that you will not accept. Except he called it unacceptable before accepting it. And 3 hours after he made that statement, he gave the order for another $350 million worth of ammunition to be sent to the very country that carried out this unacceptable act. So, just in case they ran out of ammunition, in order to do more of it, he ensured that they were resupplied. So what we've got now, and it's still going on as we speak, people are still being slaughtered. Most of them are women and children. Increasingly, they're in hospitals and in schools when they're being attacked. And there's no sign either of them stopping of their own volition, and absolutely no sign that the world, which makes it all possible, is going to stop them. So the Palestinians are entirely alone, except for you, except for the public. When I took the second or third of the convoys with which I broke the siege in Gaza after the last Operation Cast Lead over Christmas time 2008-2009, I went to a house that had just been destroyed, and I met a young girl whose entire family had been wiped out. She had been staying with her grandmother and her life was spared. And she stood there in the ruins trying to collect any remaining pieces of her family's life that she could find. And this is what she said to me. She said it twice, although the second time was to my back, because I could no longer look in her eyes as she was saying it. She said, where is this Ummah that they teach us about in school? Where is this Ummah? Why did they leave us alone? What did we do to deserve being left to face this alone? For those who are not Muslim here, the Ummah is the people, the nation, the Muslim people. Where are they, this young child who'd lost her entire family, asked me. All I could say to her was that they're in meetings like this in Leeds, like meetings like the one we had last Saturday in Manchester, or last Saturday afternoon in Bradford, or every week now in London.
If by Ummah she meant the corrupt kings and the puppet presidents who rule the Muslim world almost without exception from one end to the other, she was of course fooling herself, because not only has not a single one of those leaders lifted a single finger to come to the aid of their co-religionists being slaughtered during Ramadan, on the Eid day, children were slaughtered. Not only did not one of these leaders lift a finger to help, many of these leaders are openly collaborating with the murderers. General Sisi is just the most obvious. The King of Saudi Arabia, the Kings of Qatar and the other places are all culpable in this. Every Arab country that has relations with Israel has opened or secret relations with Israel. The King of Qatar owns Al Jazeera, telling everyone the story, and he's shopping in Tel Aviv. Qatar is not only host to the biggest American base in the entire world, but has an open diplomatic relation with Israel, with an ambassador and an embassy, and the Mossad in his capital, and so on. In fact, the Mossad will be providing the security in Qatar for the World Cup, if it ever gets there. These traitors betrayed that girl, and betrayed all these victims, and all these people who've lost so much. But I believe, and this, you can't see what I can see, this meeting is standing room only, right out into the street. There are hundreds of people here. And it's true every day and every night at every meeting that I speak at. There are some bright spots even in this darkest night that we're going through. And it's a real paradox. In the Western countries, in the non-Muslim countries, there's a gigantic swell of support for Palestine and rejection of Israel. At first it was only young heroes like Tom Herndel and the American girl that was...
Rachel Corrie
that was cruelly bulldozed by an Israeli bulldozer. One or two white Western non-Muslim people that were standing up for Palestine. Now, all over the world, from Toronto to Argentina to Tokyo to everywhere, somebody sent a photographer in to take my picture today from Sweden for an event that's taking place there tomorrow afternoon. All over the world, people who have no obligation. Here I address the Muslims. The Muslims have a duty, a wajib, obligatory obligation. Wajib, not optional, must, to defend Palestine, to defend the mosque, Al-Aqsa, in Jerusalem. But these Western people who are not Muslims have no obligation at all. And they have many other things that they could be occupying their time with. But if you look at these demonstrations, Western, white, non-Muslim people are in their tens, hundreds of thousands, on these demonstrations. This kafir that I can see all around this hall has become an emblem all over the world for fighting for freedom. The Palestinian flag, which 10 years ago, believe me, I've been in this struggle for 40 years, 10 years ago, almost nobody could have identified the Palestinian flag. This afternoon, in the street in Bradford, what was the name of the street? Skinner Lane. Four young girls, not six, saw the Palestinian flag on our car and ran after it shouting, "Free, free Palestine!" Six-year-old girls in the center of Bradford. This uprising is going to change everything. Because what I'm going to say to you next concerns your duty. In Bradford, we have established Bradford
boycott. We have declared Bradford an Israel-free zone. We don't want any Israeli goods. We don't want any Israeli services. We don't want any Israeli academics coming to the university or the college. We don't even want any Israeli tourists to come to Bradford, even if any of them had thought of doing so. We reject this illegal, barbarous, savage state that calls itself Israel. And you have to do the same. Leeds, which is a much bigger city, and as this meeting proves, has the basis of a huge campaign here. You have to not only boycott anything to do with Israel, you have to actively, proactively, seek out those businesses that are profiting from the occupation of Palestine and picket them. And it works. Yesterday in Bradford, Tesco was a ghost town. I mean, Tesco was already in trouble. Yesterday in Bradford, nobody was in it. Nobody. Because we put a picket outside. We told the people who came inside this shop are the products stained in blood. Profits with blood on the banknotes are being made inside this shop. It would be, to the religious people, we said, it would be a sin to go into this shop and buy, because you'll be contributing to the profits of this store, some of which will end up paying for the crimes in Israel. And to the non-religious people, we said, do you want to, on your conscience, that you helped Israel do what it's doing? And almost every customer turned away. McDonald's, we picketed beyond midnight last night. It was a ghost town. Nobody was in McDonald's. There are women here, inadvertently, who have Palestinian blood on their faces. What do I mean? There are women here wearing Estee Lauder or L'Oreal. These are companies that are giving a fortune to Israel. And they are making a fortune from products that they steal from illegally occupied Palestinian land. Don't wear Palestinian blood on your face. Don't eat blood-stained oranges out of Tesco or courgettes that are stained with the lifeblood of Palestinian people. We have to become proactive on this. So I'm asking you, follow our model. We've set up Bradford boycott. Set up a Leeds boycott. Get a website. Get a Facebook page. Link yourselves all together. And we can really hit them where it hurts. And my last point is this. And it's, I'm sorry to say, a discordant one. All of the mainstream British political parties support Israel. In fact, every one of them has a Friends of Israel inside their own party. You cannot be the minister for the Middle East in Britain unless you were a member, preferably a leading member, of the Labour Friends of Israel, the Conservative Friends of Israel, the Liberal Democrat Friends of Israel. I promise you something. There will never be a respect Friends of Israel. Never. We will never allow any friend of Israel to be a member of respect. And I think that's something to bear in mind. Because it's not really that they're friends of Israel. They just want to please the people who are friends of Israel. What does that mean? That means they have no interest in pleasing you. Even though there's far more of you. Even though, if it's about money, you've got far more money than the friends of Israel have. But they're frightened of the friends of Israel, and they're not frightened of you. Why are they not frightened of you? Because they think you have no choice but to vote for them. They think they can do anything to you, and you'll still vote for them. And guess what? They're usually right about that. And as long as they're right about it, why should they change? If they need to please the friends of Israel in order to get their support, but they don't have to please you, why should they choose you? They have no principles, these people. They're acting only out of interest. And you have to change that paradigm. You have to tell your politicians here in Leeds, who will be asking you for their vote in just 9 months' time, well, what did you do in the war? Did you do anything in the war? Did you say a single word? Did you march a single mile? Did you come on the pickets or the boycotts? What did you do while this war's going on? And if their answer is, I did nothing, why should you vote for them? Why should they be able to get your vote so cheaply? I always make this point. Every president of the United States of America has to discover a long-lost Irish relative. Even Obama found a long-lost Irish auntie. I don't know how that worked. But why did they do that? Because there are 30 million Irish Americans who don't give their votes away cheaply. There are 30 million Irish Americans who say, if you want our vote, what are you going to do for Ireland? What are you going to do for the Irish people? What are you going to do for the freedom of Ireland? What are you going to do about British occupation in Ireland? That's why the American politicians get the shillelagh out and the pint of Guinness and pretend to be Irish. They don't do that with you because they don't have to, because you give your votes away for nothing. And that's what's got to change. And that's why I'm asking you to join the Respect Party. You can do it online, respectparty.org. Because only if there is an alternative, and we've got leaflets there, only if there's an alternative that you might vote for, can you expect these parties to do anything for you. If they think they've got your vote anyway, then why should they try to please you? So, that's what I'm here to say. That's what I'm here to ask. And now it's your turn. We've got plenty of time for Q&A. Who wants to ask the first question? Yes, the lady there, yes.
They should have gone obviously in Leeds, Interpol. That's the one to go for. There won't be others, but that's the one I recommend. Yes, sir. The brother asks about convoys. Well, as the organizer of five of those, I'm in a pretty good position, I think, to tell you that no convoy is possible at this time for a number of reasons. First of all, there are only two ways to Gaza, both of which, of course, go through Egypt, but there are only two ways that you can do that. The first would require you traveling across North Africa and therefore through Libya, and as there is a raging civil war involving at least six different parties in Libya, that is completely impossible. And the second would be through Turkey into Syria and Italy. There's a raging civil war involving at least six parties going on in Syria, and no one could safely pass through it. In any case, all roads lead through Egypt. And General Sisi, the military dictator in Egypt, even turned back a Tunisian Air flight last week laden with emergency medical supplies that the government of a fellow Arab country had sent, and the Egyptian air traffic control refused their permission to land in Cairo and they had to fly back to Tunis. So even if you went through Libya, or even if you went through Syria, you wouldn't get past Egypt. So it's not cost effective. It was never really cost effective, to be honest. It was about dramatizing the situation, drawing attention to it, helping to build the campaign and so on. But it's now not cost-effective and not practical. So it's not an answer, I'm afraid. Yes, in the middle there. Yes, dear.
You mentioned that Bundesliga are winning the Zionist state. How do you know who else is winning this? Because they don't know when they advertise that they are, providing funds for Israel. How do you know who is winning?
Well, almost all of the funds for Israel come from the United States. $3 billion a year goes directly from the American taxpayer to Israel. And another $4 billion a year comes through private philanthropy. The Zionist organizations in America, who are mainly not Jewish, by the way, but fundamentalist evangelical Christians, make up a total of $7 billion US dollars a year, going to a country of 7 million people. Do the maths. That's a very, very substantial subvention. And Israel is the largest beneficiary of American aid, even though Israel is a prosperous Western country and doesn't need any aid at all. Most of that aid is, of course, military aid, and that's what's raining down on the Palestinians now. The rest of us contribute in these ways. You may see in the Independent newspaper this morning the huge number of contracts that our Ministry of Defense has signed with Israeli military suppliers. It's not that we are giving weapons to Israel, it's that Israel is selling weapons to us, because their weapons industry is extremely developed. So we are giving them British taxpayers' money for weapons that they have produced, which are in the first place tested on the captive Palestinian population under siege or occupation. A second way is that we treat Israel as if it were a member of the European Union. We even allow them to sing in the Eurovision Song Contest, play in the European Football Championships, have almost member state access to our markets for their products, much of which are produced in illegally occupied settlements. We have to stop that. That's part of the boycott campaign. And we have to stop Israel being treated as a normal state when it is, in fact, a rogue terrorist state. It's the Palestinians that are the victims of terrorism, and it's Israel who are the terrorists. This is a paradigm which has got to be broken through. This concept that it's the other way around, that according to the BBC, Israel is pursuing an operation targeting militants, even though they know the overwhelming majority of the dead are women and children, where Israelis are said to have been killed while Palestinians merely die, mysteriously they just die. Well, the BBC headline yesterday, in the midst of this sea of killing, was militants seize Israeli soldier. One soldier trumps 50s, hundreds of Palestinian dead. This is the paradigm that we have to break. Egypt gives subsidized oil to Israel and gas to Israel at a price lower than it charges the Egyptian public itself. Imagine. That was started under Mubarak, but has continued since Mubarak was overthrown. Qatar has normal diplomatic relations with Israel. And the king, previous king, I don't know about his son that's now in power, previous king and his wife, Sheikh Moza, were often shopping in Tel Aviv, photographed shopping in Tel Aviv. Just, by the way, Tel Aviv and Israel have to be exposed, ruthlessly exposed. It causes me a lot of problems. I'm now unable to travel to hardly any Arab country anywhere in the world. I'm going to Beirut tomorrow, that's about the last one that I'm allowed to go in. But there's no option, there's no choice, we can't pretend otherwise. But it's not just the Arabs, where's Pakistan? Why didn't Nawaz Sharif demand that Israel stop bombing the Gaza Strip? Why didn't he even hint that the huge Pakistani army might actually do something about it?
the Saudis have a gigantic fleet of weaponry. Billions, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of advanced weaponry. Why didn't they even hint that they might use it to defend the Palestinian people? Why didn't King Abdullah even hint that he might follow the lead of King Faisal in 1973 and use Saudi Arabia's oil weapon and the threat to embargo countries that are supporting Israel? Why didn't he do that? Somebody said to me, because he's afraid of what the Americans would do to him. For God's sake, he's about 91. How many more years is he expecting to live? At least if he did die, he might have a better chance of getting into heaven than he currently does. Who's next? Yes, the gentleman standing up against the wall.
From the deepest part of my heart, to thank you for everything you're doing. Unlike the... Unlike the ones who are supposed to be our brothers, who we share the same religion, blood and history, for us and don't know where, what the Zionists are doing. And there are two points that I want you to emphasize on, too. You're reading through the media, especially the Western media, which is exploited in a disgusting way, when you hear about the Zionist gangs. There are two allegations that are virally now on the website that you can see. The first one is Hamas is violating international law by targeting civilians by their rockets. And it gave me a lot of sadness when one of the most solid defenders of our court got caught in the moral maze on the BBC radio.
Who was that?
Mehdi Hassan. And he couldn't say anything about, so yes, they are violating international law. And that's the first thing. And the second thing is, you can see the disgusting comments on under the website on various Facebook pages, the Independent and Daily Mail, that, okay, Arabs and Muslims are killing each other every day. Why all of that waffle about Zionists killing Palestinians? How can we debunk this, these messages?
Well, on the first one, the Palestinian weaponry is so primitive that it can't target anyone. So it's not true that it's targeting civilians. It has no targeting. It's merely a firework that goes up and comes down. And incidentally, have you ever seen any film of one of these Palestinian rockets landing in Israel? I myself have not. I have grave doubts about the number of these rockets that they keep claiming. They say that the Iron Dome brings many of them down. Have any of you seen a picture of an Iron Dome missile shooting down a Palestinian missile? I myself have not. I think that there's a very great deal of propaganda about these rockets. But in any case, a people who are invaded and illegally occupied have the right to defend themselves. And that's what the Palestinians are doing. And to paraphrase Ben Bella, at the height of the Algerian struggle, when the French said that the FLN, the freedom fighters in Algeria fighting for independence from France, were carrying bombs in baby carriages, Ben Bella said, give us helicopters, give us aeroplanes, give us tanks, give us missiles, and we'll give you our baby carriages. The Palestinians are using the weapons they have because that's the only weapons that they have. So, unless you take the view, perhaps Mehdi Hassan did on the moral maze. Maybe that's why they didn't invite me onto the moral maze. Incidentally, in the last 4 weeks, have you seen me on BBC? Have you seen me on Sky? None of them have called me. And I'm one of the leading figures in the country on this subject for decades, 40 years. None of them have invited me onto these programs. But if I'd been on the moral maze, I would have said this. You either take the view that an occupied people have no right to defend themselves, or you take the view that they have the right to defend themselves. I take the latter. And if Israel doesn't want to deal with the consequences of that resistance, then it should grant the Palestinian people justice. No justice, no peace. It's really not rocket science. On the second point, they've got a point. Muslims are slaughtering Muslims. Arabs are slaughtering Muslims. Arabs are slaughtering Arab Christians and religious minorities of all kinds in Iraq and in Syria. That's true. But we are not responsible for that. We are responsible for what's happening in Palestine. Because it was us, our country, Britain, which authored this entire tragedy in the first place. Maybe some of you don't know that. The only reason why there is anything called Israel, the only reason why the Palestinians have suffered this calamity, is because Britain, on behalf of one people, promised a second people, the Zionists, the land which belonged to a third people, the Palestinians, before we even controlled it, by the way, even as an imperial possession. So we created this disaster. And we are not supporting the ISIS and the Al-Qaeda and so on in Syria, although the government tried very hard to do so until we stopped them in the House of Commons. But we are supporting Israel. So we are helping Israel carry out these crimes. And that's what makes it different from the ISIS or any other Muslim-Muslim wars and killing. Yes, madam.
I just want to ask, why did Britain give
The lady asked, why did Britain do this? There is a clip actually on YouTube in which I argue with a young Zionist on this very point, and he keeps saying Britain gave us this land, and I kept saying, what right did Britain have to give you somebody else's land? And when you put it that way, it's kind of unanswerable. Britain wanted, in the words of Balfour at the time, to have a loyal little Jewish Ulster in the heart of the Middle East. For those of you who don't know, Ulster, or most of it, is in Northern Ireland, what they call Northern Ireland. The British planted settlers there, in parts of Ulster, most of them Scottish, in fact, in order that they would be the loyal vanguard of British interests in Ireland. And it worked very well until now. The north of Ireland is still not a part of its hinterland, and Ireland is not complete. So Balfour was clear. If we back the Zionists' claim to build a state there, they'll be loyal to us. They'll follow our interests. Now, they did that, but only very briefly, because the British Empire was superseded by the American, and in fact, they're not a little loyal Jewish Ulster for us, they're a little loyal settler state for the United States of America. But here's something you probably don't know, that you should. First of all, none of the Zionist leaders to whom Balfour promised Palestine, none of them believed in God. That's their business. I mention it only because you nowadays hear over and over again that there is some biblical title that they are merely redeeming. That God, as an estate agent, promised them this land and that therefore they have the right to have it. But the Zionists, not only none of them believed in the Bible, all of them were atheists, but more importantly, they were already negotiating with the British for several other places in the world where they could build a state called Israel. They asked the British if they could have the Seychelles. Would Britain give them the Seychelles and they would establish Israel there? They asked the British if they could have Uganda and they would establish a state called Israel there. They asked the British if they could have Patagonia, which is where the Welsh-speaking people are in Argentina. They asked the British if they would back them to create Israel in South America, in Argentina. In other words, all this bull that they are there because they have some divine, biblical, religious right, even obligation to be there, is absolute nonsense. In any case, most Israelis are not religious in any way. In fact, most Israelis hate the religious Jews and many of the religious Jews hate Israel. If you've seen the rabbis on our demonstrations, for example, that's the explanation for that. And the reality is that this is not about the prophets. This is about the prophets. It's not about peace be upon them. It's about how to get a piece of them. Yes, the gentleman right at the back in the grey shirt.
John, what's the solution to all this thing? For over 10 years now, we've seen today,
we've
carried
on. I wish it was only a decade, brother. Then I'd be much younger than I am. It started in 1948. It became much worse in 1967 when Israel occupied the remaining tiny parts of Palestine that we now know as the West Bank and Gaza, as well as East Jerusalem. It was followed in 1970 by the Jordanian regime's massacre of the Palestinian resistance in Black September of 1970 in Jordan, and it continued with the Israeli invasion and massacre of Sabra and Shatila in 1982 in Lebanon, and it continued in every massacre and disaster that has overcome the Palestinians till then. Everybody's got their own solution, brother. This is my solution. With apologies to any Palestinians here who take a different view. To me, the only solution in this tiny piece of land is one democratic state between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. There is no room for two states. There is no chance of two states. Israel will never accept two states. In any case, as I pointed out to you right at the beginning, the West Bank and Gaza are not contiguous territories. So what you would have, if you had a two-state solution, even if one were possible, would be a series of Bantustans that were called Palestinian states, but which were nothing of the kind. In any case, when Arafat signed the Oslo Agreement, I supported it because I was with Arafat. And I supported it because he persuaded me that this is the best we can do and that it will be a dynamic situation, that we can grow from there. But actually the reverse has happened. Oslo has not led to a single centimetre. It's 20 years old, by the way, Oslo. All that fanfare. 20 years old. Not a single centimetre of Palestine is free after 20 years of Oslo. But large parts of what was going to be the Palestinian state have now been illegally settled. An apartheid wall has been built, military roads, checkpoints and so on. In my opinion, it's all gone too far demographically to separate these two territories. In any case, what's wrong with one democratic state? What's wrong with a state where Jews and Muslims and Christians live as equal citizens under the law? That's what we ask for everywhere else. Why shouldn't we demand it in Palestine? And for those who say, you might be one. For those who say, that's a pipe dream, it will never happen, Israel will never agree to that. Well, they're not agreeing to anything else. So why should I fight for something else, which isn't a solution? Because it doesn't allow the millions of Palestinian refugees to return home, rather than fight for something that's right and just and democratic.
And that's where we'll have to leave that lecture by George Galloway. And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, which is a weekly segment here on 90.3 FM Newton. And it's part of Truth and Justice Radio, which airs every Sunday from 6 to 10 a.m. We hope that you'll join us again for news and views from and about Palestine. And also wanted to give a nod to a series called The Injustice System and the Crazy Old Man Network for finding that recording.